Hey guys, I hope you're loving the Making Bank episodes. Please make sure you guys like and share these episodes, as well as comment below for the guests. They love to come back and interact with you. And I really appreciate you watching and listening to Making Bank, so thank you.
You are listening to Making Bank, where we uncover the mindset and success strategies of the top 1% so you can amplify your life and your business.
Welcome to Making Bank. I am Josh Felber, where we uncover the mindset and the success strategies of the top 1% so you can amplify your life and your business today. Super honored and excited for today's guest, Eric Van Horn, Cody Sperber, Phil Jones, Michael Burnoff, Aaron Stokes, Philip Stutz, Near AL. What was that first business then from there that you started?
So a couple of friends of mine were looking at a franchise, and I had no idea what a franchise was, a discovery day, and all the insider jargon to franchising.
Sure.
But I was thrown right into it. And so I basically went to a big annual franchise convention for this first franchise that I bought. I didn't realize it was a convention and a big party at the time. I just knew it was really good food and it was free. And there was a lot of people having a lot of fun there. And so, you know, within a few short months, I realized that the guy that was leading this brand had franchise experience before, so he could shortcut that process. And I also knew that he had sold his last company and was really good at bringing in new franchisees. And I wanted to learn that game of how to take somebody that is just interested in buying something, getting into business, to actually them owning a franchise. So I not only bought my first franchise with him, I started to work for him. And that's where I really got ingrained in the franchise development side, which is selling franchises. So I started my first franchise living in Virginia Beach. I started it in Kansas City, and I started a handful of locations for Liberty Tax Service. And then at the end of that tax year, which is, you know, in April, I went back to the corporate office in Virginia Beach, and I started to sell franchises for that company.
Oh, wow. That's awesome. Now, how did that help you moving forward then? Because I know with everything that you're doing now and opening up multiple franchises, did you kind of stay focused on continuing to open up franchises at that point, or?
Yeah. So at that point, I had regional development. So I had 42 locations that were basically under my wing, and I helped and I mentored all of the franchisees in that. And in return, I would get half of the royalties. So I bought that. And then in addition to having those 42 stores, I had 12 stores of my own over a 9-year period. So I would buy them. I would starting from scratch, I would buy out existing ones, and then I would make them better and sell them. And that's one of the things that I was doing. And I was mentoring a lot of franchisees along the way. So, and then I would go back and work for the corporate office selling franchises during the time when we weren't running our franchises. So I just got to see all the inner workings. And one thing that was really interesting is seeing the franchisor-franchisee relationship, because at times that could get strained. And especially in today's climate, there's a lot of new franchisees out there, and there's a lot of strain that can happen. So I was the franchisee. I was a regional developer. So I was basically a franchisor to different franchisees in my region.
Okay.
And then I basically reported to the franchisor. So I was a middleman in a lot of it. So what that helped me do is understand the pull from the franchisee and the pull from the franchisor. Once I started to get all of that, I wanted to exit that business just because of some things that were coming down. I just didn't want to be in that tax business anymore.
Right.
It's really more of a marketing business than a tax business, because I'm more of a marketer. So I exited that. And that's really when I took all of my experience that I had, and I started to buy other franchises. And then I was like, I knew a lot about an industry and a brand, but I didn't know a lot about other industries. So that's when I went into franchise consulting, because I knew franchise consultants had access to brands that they could help other people buy, but they were really good at just getting, they had access to that stuff. They didn't have what I had. They didn't have the understanding of how business works, how franchising works as an owner. And so I combined that, and that's when I started to buy more brands, and that's when I really started to grow. And I started helping a lot of friends and family buy different brands, because they would see what I was looking at and I would tell them, and they're like, that looks interesting, I'll do that too. And so that's what I've been doing for the past, almost 10 years.
What were some of the challenges working with all the different franchisees and you owning them and things like that, that you found along the way that were challenges to the franchisee, why they didn't reach their full potential?
A lot of franchise, well, they're always focused on somebody else. They're always focused on like what, one of the things is the franchisees very typically say, you don't understand. As a regional developer, if I owned franchises in that brand, they would say, you're too busy working on your own franchises. If I didn't own franchises, they would say, you don't understand because you're not in it. So there was always an excuse. There's an excuse for everything, but that's, you know, whether it was right or wrong, that's the, one of the things that franchisees do. I do it, you know, as an owner. And so I wanted to just, you know, not make any excuses. And I really, you know, dealt with what the franchisor gave me in terms of an operating model, and I would execute that. But more importantly, I would go to the top franchisees, the top performers, the top 1, 2, 3, 5% of owners out there and figure out what they're doing, why they're successful versus like being in a, in, you know, in a bunch of miserable franchisees on everybody telling everybody else why they're not successful. Right. So I went to the top performers. I found out what they're doing that is different than everybody else. And some of it's mindset, some of it's tactical, but that's when I'm like, gosh, you know, the franchisor gives you the playbook, but also the secret to it is getting in with the in crowd, the franchisees that are killing it. And then, you know, getting into that crowd and learning from them. That's really how you shortcut the speed to profitability, the speed to having, you know, significant net worth.
Cool. Kind of throughout that initial journey, what was, I guess, a couple of the biggest challenges that you really had to overcome to get, I guess, even to that million or multi-million?
Yeah, I mean, God, there's, I'm sure well, every person million. You talk to has that, like, it's such a long list. Big ones, the initial period was all overcoming self-limiting beliefs. I looked young. Why would anybody think I'm going to pay cash for their house? I drove a piece of crap Nissan pickup truck. I'm pulling up to their house. I look like I'm 12. My pitch is, I'm going to pay cash for your house and stop your foreclosure. They're like, okay, go get your dad and come on back. And so I had a lot of self-limiting beliefs in emotional baggage from being that kid that was bullied, that had constant change, trying to prove myself to my parents and to the world that I'm worthy of making money and I could do this. So that was a large portion of it. And then overwhelm was a large portion of it. I was getting very overwhelmed. Real estate can seem very complicated.
Sure.
Especially when you're new and you don't have money and you don't have a mentor. And so I was floundering a lot that first year, trying different things. And I was the typical wannabe-preneur that, you know, knew that I really couldn't do or hack anything else. Like, I'm only an entrepreneur because I would really suck at everything else.
Right.
I wish it was. It's so difficult to be an entrepreneur and run businesses and build teams and scale and all that stuff that I wish I could just go get a 9-to-5 and be great at that. Unfortunately, I'm not designed that way.
Right.
I don't thrive in that environment. I think there's two types of entrepreneurs, and I think I've done a good job hiring intrapreneurs, which are people that have a big vision and that like autonomy and that are very talented that can be part of a team or a big, even bigger vision of a lead entrepreneur. So it's multiple entrepreneurs in alignment. But yeah, I was struggling with a lot of overwhelm. It felt like I was drinking from a fire hose. So I was dealing with that. And then I had failed partnerships where I started partnerships with people and I picked the wrong partners. I didn't understand. I thought, I'm aggressive, they're aggressive, let's go be aggressive together and we're gonna go make all this money. But 1 + 1 has to equal 5. It can't equal 2.
Sure.
And especially if they're too aggressive, dominant, salespeople or marketing people or whatever, which was where I always leaned more towards. And so I picked the wrong partners. She cleaned out my bank account one day. I remember being just, we closed a big deal. It was like $75,000 or $80,000 in the bank account. And she cleaned it out and called me up and said, I don't want to be your partner anymore. And that was a big hurdle. Getting into legal troubles, not filling out my paperwork correctly, not getting stuck into bad deals. I mean, there's literally dozens of these moments where you're laying in bed at night and you're so angry and you feel like this injustice is happening as an entrepreneur and you feel helpless and you gotta make a call. Like, you can either keep crying about it and whining about it, or you gotta get up the next day, wake up, bounce back and have that bounce back spirit, learn from it and keep moving forward. And I have been fortunate enough that for the dozens, if not hundreds, of mistakes or marketing things where I throw. People know me now, and they see this life.
Right.
Where it's like, this. Oh, I'm on Facebook. I spend millions of dollars in advertising.
Right.
And they're like, dude, this guy's got it all figured out. I can't tell you. There's not a week that goes by. Before we started this, I was yelling at my marketing team, going, dude, we spent $20,000 and got no sales from it. What the heck is going on? You know. So it happens constantly, but that willing to take those risks and try those things, for all of those failures, I've significantly made way more money and had more wins because I was willing to take those risks and fight through those challenges.
So through that, and obviously, you know, as entrepreneurs, we have a lot of those failures. I mean, I've had bad partnerships and people wipe out the bank account and you're like, what? There's $1 left, you know, and everything. But for you, what keeps you going? What drives you through that? You know, because some people hit that and they're like, ah, man, and they give up, or, you know, oh, this happened to me. But what pushes you and gets you there to that next day,
Yeah, well, in the beginning, it was necessary for me to make money. I was so broke.
Right.
I had to fight through it. I didn't have a choice. But as I started growing, I think a couple of things. Family. I had some pretty big whys in my life of wanting to help my dad and retire my dad. You know, he's gone through some things. He's always been there for me, and he was my hero growing up. And then being empowered through my real estate income to be able to give back to him. I retired my dad right around the time I was becoming a millionaire. I was able to retire
That's
my
awesome.
Parents. He actually now works for me, and it's been the greatest blessing of my life to be able to go to work every single day and work with my family.
That's
now
cool.
I take my son to a lot of my rehabs on the weekends and nights and stuff like that. And so getting him now involved, now that he's, since he was 7, I started bringing him with me. Now he's 10. He like runs job sites. He like rolls around and, you know, gives people raises and hires and fires. I'm like, what are you doing? You can't do that. But that's been a big driver, the family aspect and having a very strong why. Also, I've done a really good job. I think one of my core competencies is building an amazing team of people way better than me, smarter than me, faster than me, more capable than me. But I was always the enthusiastic guy that like got everybody on board, put them in the right seat of the bus. And I think a lot of entrepreneurs can relate to this if they understand this. Simon Sinek talked about, you know, understanding how to explain why people do things. So it's like most entrepreneurs know what they do. They know how they do it. Simon Sinek brought in this other piece, which was like the why piece.
The why part, right.
I think there's one more that needs to be added, and that's the what's in it for you if you do it alongside with me. If you take your big vision of wanting to be an entrepreneur and make a lot of money and help your why and your family, get that in alignment with mine. I was always really good at bringing everybody together.
Okay.
And then when that happens, now I work harder because I feel responsible and obligated to this team that I've helped assemble. And I'm willing to do things that like naturally I probably wouldn't do. It's like having a personal trainer. I'll work out harder when somebody's holding me accountable.
Right.
So I have this amazing team holding me accountable. So that's probably the magic glue in the formula between it all is family and an amazing team.
No, that's awesome. And it's super cool too, as you mentioned too, integrating your son into, you know, the rehab. That's one of the things I know I did early on. It was just integrating my kids into what we do. And, you know, now they all have, my daughter has her own business. My boys started a clothing company.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, what's the business?
So she has a pet business. She makes all natural pet care called Paleo Pets.
Oh, that's
and,
cool.
And sells it all off her website.
Dude, my wife would be all up in that. Don't tell my wife. She's going to be ordering all your products here soon.
And then my boys.
You know, my pit bull eats better than I do.
Why? Because people put so much love and attention and money towards their pets.
All organic. I'm like,
I get
like chicken fingers and French fries, and he gets all organic with organic honey. I'm like, dude, I want that.
Can we switch?
Yeah.
And then the boys it's a clothing company called Gratitude Gear, and they have like gratitude quotes and like these super comfy t-shirts and hoodies and
good job,
that,
Dad.
So integrated them in, that's where I was going with the whole story, is definitely awesome. And I think a lot of people try to find balance, but then you're always like fighting for the balance instead of creating that integration piece.
That's
I think
it.
It's pivotal.
Yeah.
So that's really awesome. I know when I was with you at your event and everything, you talked a lot about too, is kind of crafting your story.
Yep.
And so, And I thought that was really interesting is, you know, kind of having that flow or that process, whether, you know, when you're speaking to somebody, you know, whether it's over the phone or whether it's in person, to be able to find out what their needs are, create that, you know, I guess create the connection, find out their needs, and then, you know, discover what, you know, how you can match up with them.
Yep.
So I guess, you know, if we can kind of maybe touch base or, you know, maybe kind of go through those points of that, because I know a lot of people here, and then even adapt it a little bit to if you're shooting video, here's kind of, you know, kind of touch base on face-to-face and then video. That way people can kind of craft their own story.
Okay. Firstly, let me give you a lens, right?
Sure.
So I think the lens that everybody is viewing your content through is the lens, show me that you know me. Mm. Show me that you can see the world through my point of view. And I think actually anything that you are delivering in content only exists as useful if it is first provided with context.
Okay.
So content without context is noise. And what we're looking to be able to do with any early point of information is to help somebody be able to see themselves in that and help them understand that you can see the world through their lens. So what might that look like from a video point of view? What might that look like from a piece of sales copy point of view? It's probably you articulating the challenge that you're looking to help them overcome.
Okay.
And my belief is if you can articulate a challenge well enough, you can articulate somebody's problem well enough, they'll then trust you with a solution. Hmm. If you're in a position where what you can do is explain to them you understand something that's causing them difficulty better than they've been able to articulate it themselves, they're way more likely to be able to actually say, I think you're the person to help us move forward with this. So there's a first point in crafting your story.
Right.
It's probably less about you.
Right.
Is your story has probably very little of you in it. Your story should be more about the people that you serve. There are two problems that every entrepreneur needs to know the answer to. And the first of those questions is, what are the problems that you solve?
Sure.
And the second is, who are the people that you help? Now, you can flip the order around on that, but if you don't have clarity over those two things, then what you are is you're a product creator. Mm. You haven't got a business.
Right.
So I think, yeah, problem that you solve and the people that you help is the starting point. I think you should craft your messaging around conversations towards your knowledge and understanding of those people that you help and the problems that you solve for them. And then you have to watch some real common mistakes that people make in language. Let's just take an about page on a website, right? And I have fun with about pages on websites. They're like, they drive me crazy. Is more often than not, they've been written with one user in mind, and the person they've been written for is the person that wrote it.
Right. Right.
Like about us is really about me, right?
It's true.
Like, like, let me tell you my story through my lens. And a classic example is like, we were founded in 1986 or we were founded in 2004. Nobody gives a damn. Like, okay, who was at that party where you were founded? It was like you and nobody else. And the overuse of the word we in conversational copy is like you're literally weeing all over your prospects, right? They're probably not going to like it.
Right.
Take a we were founded in 1986 and change it to since 1986, the people of insert blank location or people with these challenges have been benefiting from the services that we provide, resulting in blank, blank, and blank.
Right.
Now, all of a sudden, what you are is the guide. So I think the lens is, are you familiar with, say, the Harry Potter movies? Or
right. Oh, yeah.
So what everybody wants to be in their business is they want to be Harry Potter. They want to be on the cover of the book. They want to be the story. They want the whole thing to be about them. That, to me, is a mistake. What everybody in business should look to be is they should look to be Dumbledore.
Right.
They should look to be able to actually make their consumer Harry Potter so that they are the hero of their own journey. And your product or service is nothing more than the wand, but your role in it is to be able to help guide them, to be able to get best access out of the tools that you provide for them, letting them come out as a hero as being the other side. And watch what happens is people will enjoy spending money with you more so.
That's interesting. Yeah, that's a good analogy.
Thanks. I thought of it the other day. I'm like, I like that. I like that.
My daughter will like that because she likes Harry Potter a lot too.
Yeah, I think my British accent piece is probably part of this. And through my work with what I've done with the book Exactly What to Say and some of the other pieces that we've kind of put out, I get pushed back and questioned a lot about, you know, specific pieces of word choices in and around things. And even broader than the scope of where my core work sits, people still see me as the, you know, the go-to person when it comes to how to be able to phrase something or how to be able to position something. So I do get the joy of being able to see things through dozens of people's sets of eyes and people cast about us, you know, or like homepages of websites passed us a lot, or, you know, I've done this teaser scripting towards a sales video, et cetera. What do you think? And I like to stay sharp by seeing those things, but every single time the commonality in something that just doesn't feel quite right is because the person that is writing or the person that is speaking is trying to make themselves out to be the star. And that naturally creates a point of friction.
Right. Yeah, no, that's interesting because, you know, when you were talking about it, I mean, you do see that. And then I was like trying to think, I'm like, yeah, how does mine read? I know we rewrote it recently and it's story based, but I'm trying to remember.
Sure. And the reality, though, is you can't not do this. Like it's hard to not make this mistake time and time again, because it's actually the most natural way of being able to position something. You actually almost have to put, you know, a giant piece of friction in. The other thing to then consider on this is I see a lot is where people say things like, you know, we provide a comprehensive service. We provide a, you know, a fantastic in-depth service, or they provide some adjective towards the type of service that is then provided. Sure. And then I try and explain to those people that those aren't your words to say. I can't tell you I offer great service. I can deliver you a service and you can say that was great service.
Right.
You can describe the service that you offer, and then the other person can say, wow, that's great service. But we put these lazy adjectives towards the level of service that we're bringing and without full context. If you want to be able to say, you know, we deliver great service, you could say in serving 2,432 people like this, they often describe our service as great.
Okay.
And now we shift it into the third person narrative. And now all of a sudden what it does is it hits with power. It is like you describing your service is great is like you saying, look at my child. They're the most beautiful thing in the world, don't you think?
Sure.
Right? And you're not going to be convinced otherwise, right? You believe that fundamentally, but the rest of the world might have some debate.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about, I guess, maybe that 1% of the audience that doesn't know who you are. A little bit about your background and kind of what got you on your path here.
I mean, how far back do we want to go? Sesame Street, or how far are we going back?
Well, I guess, where did it all happen for you?
So business-wise, I mean, I'll put it this way, from an entrepreneur standpoint, because that's mainly, you know, who we're targeting right now, is I went to business for myself. I was, you know, young. My parents taught me, you know, work hard, be a good person. Then I'm finally in business for myself, struggling like you wouldn't believe. And I came across personal development, and literally had a college professor, Robert Cialdini, which is crazy. I don't know if I've ever told you that before.
And I've interviewed Robert. Influence. It's crazy. So, yeah.
He was a college professor. I barely even paid attention in the class, which is, don't tell him that. Well, I guess everybody knows that now.
Yeah,
see that now. Is I went into business with myself, and I screwed up. I stumbled across personal development, and I stumbled across influence and neuro-linguistic programming and stuff. Right. And I go, wow, these are words and names for things I've been thinking about my entire life. And I watched my entire life change when I recognized that it doesn't matter how hard you work if you're operating incorrectly. So I learned how to use my brain, communicate effectively, and everything changed when I realized that anybody can get good at anything if they know how to get good at it and who they need to get good at it from. That was everything that changed for me.
Gotcha. When we're working with people, maybe a lot of people that are watching, you know, have kids or family, yep. You know, that may have suffered some challenges or maybe are challenged right now.
Yeah.
How can we like break through to them or create?
Well, what's the challenge? That's the first question. Because this is like, I was walking out of Whole Foods in New York the other day. Crazy right. story. I ran in the rain. I walked in the rain. I didn't really just run in New York because it's so slow to go get my daughter something.
Sure.
And then I was leaving and this smart guy and we were talking about something. He goes, you ever heard of biodiversity? And I'm like, I never heard of it in my life. Have you?
No.
It's a cool term. He says, yeah. We have biology that is diverse between different people. So there isn't one thing that works with all people all the time, just like vitamins or anything else. Not
sure.
One thing works all the time. Like you might need to use it on a Tuesday, somebody on a Wednesday. Sometimes you have this background. Sometimes this is your genes.
Right.
Some things make you smell. Some things don't make you smell. So he's explained this to me. So it's like, I like to get specific on the subject matter. So it's not like do this one thing and everything works out great. Like I sound like an infomercial, right? So give me an idea. Like what are we talking about?
So
real world equation.
Real world equation. So a lot of people are in normal schools.
Yep.
They don't homeschool like we do and stuff like that. And you know what? And obviously, in normal schooling now these days, there seems to be a lot more prevalent with bullying and things like that. What's something that kids can utilize to get them past that?
Or my wife told me that I'm not allowed to tell my daughter just to walk up and say, shut up. Because I thought you could say that because we were kids. I thought right? that's what you said, but you can't say that anymore.
Not anymore.
So are we talking about physically dealing with the bully itself or afterwards?
More afterwards, okay. Yeah. Yeah.
So typically when people are being bullied or they rebully themselves in their mind. So a bully may hit right. you, a bully may physically hit you or harm you and be mean to you every day. And then what happens is you go home and you think about it all day long. So this sure. is where communication comes in and you got to be really, really careful. So I want you to think of somebody that really, really bothers you.
Okay.
Okay. Or like drives you nuts.
Right.
You got one in your head?
Yep.
Okay. If you were to close your eyes, and if you're watching this right now, you're driving, please don't close your eyes. But like if you were to close your eyes and think of someone that really bothers you or someone that intimidates you.
Sure.
Typically, human beings that are intimidated are looking up at somebody. And we're looking up at a person. It's almost like in the Jetsons. Remember our era, Jetsons and Spacely?
Right.
So Jetson's bigger, but Spacely's on a table.
Yeah.
And he's looking up at this little person. So what I recognize, like, if someone were to call the president of anything, a company, a country, whatever it is, I don't want to get into politics, but typically we picture this powerful person and we look up at them. The second you put somebody on a pedestal, you put you on the floor. So whenever we're being bullied, a lot of times in our head, the first thing we do is we picture ourselves smaller than them. So what I do is I have people like describe the bullying situation. How do you picture them? And they usually say, well, I picture them looking up at them. Great. Okay. So I want you to picture looking up at them. And then I have them close their eyes and I have them stand up. So like okay. literally stand up. Now describe how they look looking down. Well, they look small. Great. Now they still got to deal with that kid at school the next day.
Right.
But immediately the physical reaction changes the feeling in the body, but you don't tell them they're going to do it in advance. I did okay. this with a professional fighter recently who was intimidated. You know, next door we got the fighting gym, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So there's a guy, the professional fighter, he was going to fight UFC,
yep.
a really, really sharp guy. And I did a thing with him and he was kind of intimidated by the person he was going to fight. Not like scared, but like put him in a box he shouldn't have been
right.
in. I had him picture him, or he at least saw him neutral. I had him picture him, describe in detail what it would look like to see him face to face, or almost face to face, and then I had him stand up and describe the same person. This guy blew up, like his got bigger right in front of him, and I watched him. He dominated the next round. He like dropped the guy on his head the next day, like nice. Picked the guy up, destroyed him. But the reason why is he changed the perspective in his head. So things we look down on, we're not sure. looking down like we're better than it, but it's got less power over you.
Right.
So that's one of the things I do with kids is just ask the question, close your eyes, like, how do you picture that person that bothers you? And they're always like, do you look up at them or down? It's always up.
Okay.
And if you look up to somebody, they have the power.
Right.
Joel Osteen's got his pictures in the sky of like him with his Megatron, Jumbotron. Why has he got him up there? Who's up there? You know what I mean? Who's right. he trying to be? Nothing personal, but that's business. It's influence.
That's where he's putting himself, huh? Yeah. What, so with communication, so we have, that's, you know, and you can utilize that, whether it's bullying or
sales
any
call.
Type of, yeah, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, sales call.
Calls or meetings with.
I taught this lady once, like she worked with UBS Financial. They're calling the top wealthiest people in the world. And I said, who are you calling? And I said, imagine you were calling Smurfs. How would you feel if you were literally calling Smurfs? Now, I don't mean short people. I mean literal blue Smurfs.
Right.
How would the conversation go if you had to sell money to Smurfs? And literally changed her perspective. She was looking down at everybody she was calling, not down on them negatively,
right.
but more like, all right, listen, I'm in control.
It's fun. This is, yeah.
Change the control.
Interesting. I mean, so you one thing you mentioned too was the guy that you hired that stole the money and everything, you kind of, looking back, you were saying you think that you kind of did that based on the fact that you weren't comfortable with the amount of money that you made. And did you... I guess, did you know or did he kind of present himself in a certain way? Like you hired him because you knew you probably shouldn't have hired him, but you did anyways, or?
He came across as the kind of guy that was well put together, but just a tinge of sliminess, just
okay,
a smidget. And I think the ladies know what I'm talking about. Girls are better at spotting that than guys. Clean cut guy, silver hair. Guy balding, probably 6 foot, not overweight, had a goatee, no tattoos, no earrings, not that any of that's bad, but, you know, just very clean cut, driving a nice car. I thought I was stealing him from a large new car dealership. Turns out he just got caught from stealing from them. And because it's so hard to prove, you have a very hard time when somebody does it, putting them in jail.
Right.
I had the TBI, the FBI, the IRS, the Murfreesboro Police Department and the Tennessee Highway Patrol all in my office the day we turned it in.
Wow.
And I gave them a book an inch thick and they said, Aaron, this is too complicated for us to put before a jury. I said, but this is what he did. I mean, it's a very, if I laid it all out, it would take an hour to explain a very complicated scheme, like something you'd see in a movie.
And you need that on American Greed.
Oh yeah. And he,
It would fit.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's crazy.
Send that book to them.
And this dude was supposed to get married in my barn.
Wow.
A week later when we caught him. So I went to him and said, you betrayed me. Give me the keys to the Range Rover. Give me your American Express. Give me your keys to the building and give me the keys to your desk. And he's like, well, I got to get some stuff out of my desk. I said, you're not touching your desk. You tell me what you need. Because I didn't want him going in there and hiding any documents.
Right.
And then the poor girl, I had this girl that I made, you know, her get in the shuttle van, drive him home. That had to be an awkward ride. But, yeah, we got him out of the building. But I don't think I tried to steal from myself, you know, $1.3 million, $1.4 million like it ended up being. But I think that subconsciously I tried to lower my income. I absolutely think that. I was very uncomfortable with it. I was enjoying it, but I did not feel I deserved it. And, you know, like everybody teaches in personal development, there's this steady thermostat we all think we're supposed to be at. And I was totally out of sync in that thermostat. And I was trying, my subconscious, I believe, was trying to adjust me back into alignment.
Yeah. What, I guess over the 3 years, I guess, what are some of the things that helped you get through that time frame? And then, I guess let's start there. And then we only got a few minutes left.
Yeah. The number one thing would be my faith in God.
Okay.
Yeah, I got to tell you, had I not had those times where I could say, why God, why? And I cannot tell you how many times someone would pop up and encourage me. I'd get a random text, a random phone call, pat on the back when I needed it so badly, like I was about to crumble.
Yeah.
And show up. And I imagine there's a few people listening right now that have been through something like I'm describing. And I've lost more and made more than most. And the crazy thing was, I didn't fail because I didn't know how to do business.
Right.
I failed because I hired the wrong guy.
Yep.
And everybody here needs to be aware, every time you hire somebody, not only can they make you money, but they can cost you money. Typically, the guy you pay the most makes you the most. And the girl that you pay the least can cost you the most, or the girl that you pay the most and the guy that you pay the least. The person you pay the least is usually the one you got to watch. This time it was the guy I was paying the most. It was very out of sync at what normally happens in business. And it was a very difficult time. If it had not been for my faith, I would have, I don't drink or smoke, but I would have been doing that and then some. I would have gone over the deep end.
Well, in that, and you had your family too around. Just you had the God, hey, God, and then your family that.
Well, stuck. My wife, but I gotta tell you, when it got really, really bad, it drove a wedge between us. I couldn't even lean on her because she felt like it wasn't safe to be with me because all I was doing was taking from the family. It got so bad.
Gotcha. Okay.
And those that have been through what I'm talking about, you know, it's very easy for your wife to support you until you go take the last bit of her, you know, her savings without asking.
Yeah.
Kind of screws that part up a little.
Yeah. Give me a little bit of background, I guess, how you got started. And I know one of the things, too, I read was just, you know, the incurable disease that you were fighting and kind of like, I guess, some of these different challenges we'll talk about today as well, too.
Listen, I grew up in Alabama, and I was one of the first generations of ADD kids. They weren't ADHD back then, right? This is the 80s, right? I'm 25 now. And so, you know, basically I was told I was dumb. I was put in the classes below normal kids. I always know like entrepreneurs are the worst at school and the best at business, right? And I get it now because I really was awful at school, but I really understood that I could only do whatever I really cared about. That's all my attention could go to.
Right.
If I really was passionate and believed in, I think you'll probably, your audience will probably understand when this is all said and done, I get ramped up and passionate about things that I have to do what I believe in. And so I really only cared about two things growing up. One was sports and college football. And the second was, weirdly and nerdly enough, politics. I just was fascinated not necessarily by the policy, but by the game.
Okay.
Which really was just marketing, right?
Right.
And so after college, you know, I stand 5'9", 150 pounds. So college football wasn't going to be for me, or pro football. So I basically said, I want to go work in politics. And so 24 years ago, I started working on political campaigns. And I literally lived, I was like a vagabond, a homeless person. I'd live in South Dakota for a year. I'd lived in New Mexico for like a 6 to 8 weeks working on big, high-profile U.S. Senate races, governor's races, presidential campaigns. And I just fell in love. You get a bug when you work in something you're so passionate about. You work 7 days a week. What makes me a little bit different than probably you and your background is you probably started businesses at an early age.
Right.
I sacrificed everything in my entire, you know, all of my 20s to help people get elected, not to build a brand or build, you know, or build a business or anything like that. I was just out there fighting 7 days a week, fighting for the causes and the people I really believed in. And then I realized how cool it was that you could affect sort of how do you get a voter, convince a voter to vote for an unknown or even sometimes an unsavory candidate, right? And so I became obsessed with trying to figure out how that worked. What did it take to win? What, you know, some in our business, we just need to get to 50+1 to win an election. So what would it take? What are the tactics you could use? What are the strategies you can use? And then I created a political consultancy agency, and I ran that very successfully until about 2014. And then I just saw the whole media landscape change over the last few years. It hadn't caught up to sort of the political marketing. And I went, I got to jump in now and create sort of a political marketing agency and take all of the 20+ years of my work and apply it to building marketing campaigns for politicians. That blew up. We've grown that to a $30 million business in less than 5 years, and with no outside investment and no debt. And I'm the sole owner of the business. And I went, man, this is really cool. Now, this is where it got interesting. About 2015, 2016, a buddy of mine who's a huge business owner, nine-figure business owner, came to me and said, I'm obsessed with politics. I want to know how you convince voters to vote for politicians and how you can translate that into business. How do you get customers to buy into companies or products or services? Because no one is telling how you guys do it right now. And I think it's really interesting. I'd like you to apply it to my business. I write the story in the book, so you can read it there. It's too long to get into now. But we had a lot of success for this business owner. We looked at things completely different, and we just have a different mindset, a different way of looking at conversions. And so then we launched a corporate marketing company. I thought I could have it all in one house, but so many business owners are like, your website has a bunch of politicians on it. So I'm like, oh, crap. So I had to create two separate companies.
Sure.
And so now we have two thriving companies that one's a corporate marketing business and one's a political marketing business.
Even as entrepreneurs, I mean, obviously everybody thinks, I think the first thing with distraction is the phone, mm-hmm. you know, is the main thing. But I mean, as a business owner, there's so many more things, I think, that come across your desk, you know, whether it's employees or different things happening, and you're always either putting out fires and things that pull your attention away. So I like to kind of hear what your insights are from all the research and the book and everything that you've found.
Right. Overall. I mean, this is exactly the case that I make in the book, is that distraction did not start with the iPhone and Facebook and Instagram. Distraction has been around for a very, very long time. Plato talked about it 2,500 years ago. Uh-huh. He called it akrasia, the tendency to do things against our better interest. And so this is what I call the skill of the century. I mean, amazing. Imagine how powerful you would be if you did what you said you were going to do.
Sure.
Right. If you just lived with personal integrity, I mean, I wrote this book for me. I struggled with this in every domain of my life. I would say I would eat right, but I wouldn't. I would say I was going to exercise, but I'd skip it. I'd say I was going to work on that big project, and yet I'd procrastinate. I would say I was going to spend quality time with my friends, my family, my kids, and yet I wouldn't really be there. Mm. And so the idea here is that you know, we're no longer in an age where information is scarce. Who doesn't right. know what to do? We all know what to do. You want to lose weight? Who doesn't know what to do? We all know the basics. You want to be good at your job? You got to do the work, especially the hard stuff that other people don't want to do. Sure. You want to have quality relationships? You have to be fully present with people. We all know what to do. The question is, why don't we do it? And so distraction is much, much bigger than technology. And the root of why we get distracted goes much deeper than just the latest gadget.
What have you found that's triggering that response, or why is that distraction? Is it, I mean, people are bored or they're just not happy in their situation? I mean, what have you found that you've uncovered? And then kind of what are some of the steps to kind of move past that?
Yeah. So the best place to start to understand what distraction is to understand what it is not.
Okay.
So the opposite of distraction, if you ask most people what's the opposite of distraction, they'll tell you it's focus, but I don't agree.
Okay.
The opposite of distraction is not focus. The opposite of distraction is traction. That if you look at the etymology of the word, both words come from the same Latin root, trahare, which means to pull. So traction is any action that pulls you towards what you want to do, things that you do with intent.
Okay.
The opposite of traction is distraction. Now you'll notice that the word ends in A-C-T-I-O-N, that spells action, both traction right. and distraction end in action. So it's really about what action we take, either traction or distraction. Now, why is this dichotomy so important? Because anything can be a distraction. So how many times have you sat down at your desk and you say, okay, now I'm going to work on that big project. I'm finally going to do that thing that I've been meaning to do that I've been putting off. Here I go. I'm going to do it right after I check email, right? Right after I scroll that Slack channel, right after I just Google this one quick thing that feels work-related, but it's what I call pseudo-work. It feels like it's important. It feels like, oh, I got to do this anyway. Let me just check some quick email. But here's the thing. When we do that, we are prioritizing the urgent at the expense of the important. And it is a cancer to our productivity. You have to do what it is you said you are going to do. And the most pernicious distractions are the ones that don't even feel like distractions, right? I'm kind of doing worky stuff. I'm checking email. I'm productive.
Right.
Bullshit. It's just as much of a distraction as playing a video game if it's not what you plan to do with your time. Now, just as it is anything can become a distraction, anything can be an act of traction. That I don't like this silly moral hierarchy that somehow, you know, what I do with my time is morally superior to what you do with your time. You playing Candy Crush is morally inferior to me watching football. No, that's not true. Anything you decide to do with your time, as long as you do it with intent, there's nothing wrong with it. Enjoy it. Don't be guilty. Don't feel guilty about it. Do it with intent. And so what I talk about in the book is how, you know, most people, we go through life every day not accomplishing what we said we were going to do. And then even when we do a pastime, we feel guilty about it. We say to ourselves, oh, I've still got so many things on my to-do list. I haven't gotten everything done. And so we want to stop that. And so I show people techniques to enjoy the pastimes fully without guilt that you have to be somewhere else. And I show you exactly how to do that. Now, to answer your question about, well, what's the root cause of distraction? Where does it really come from? There are two types of triggers. We have what's called external triggers, the pings, the dings, the rings, sure. all of these things in our yep. outside environment. That's what we tend to blame for distraction. But then there are also what we call the internal triggers. And it turns out that most distraction does not start outside of us, but rather it starts from within. Mm. Yeah. That these internal triggers are about a desire to escape an uncomfortable sensation. So if you think about, you know, this question of why do we get distracted, we have to start a layer deeper. Why do we do everything? And most people will tell you that the seat of human motivation is about pursuing pleasure and avoiding pain, right? Carrots and sticks. Turns right. out it's not true.
Oh, wow. Okay.
It is not true. That in fact, neurologically speaking, the brain doesn't get us to act in pursuit of pleasure and the avoidance of pain, but in fact, it's pain all the way down.
Mm.
Everything you do for one reason, to modulate your mood, to feel something different, particularly when it comes to avoiding discomfort, right? So everything you do, think about this from a physiological standpoint. If you go outside and it's cold, you put on a jacket. If you come back inside, it's too hot, you take it off. If you're hungry, you feel hunger pangs, so you eat. And if you eat too much, oh, now you're stuffed, you stop eating. So those are physiological responses. The same holds true for psychological responses. When you're feeling lonely, check Facebook. When you're bored, you check sports scores, stock prices. When you're uncertain, you check Google.
Right.
And so everything we do is about this desire to escape discomfort, which means, and this is really important, time management is pain management. If you don't learn how to deal with discomfort in a healthier manner, let me tell you, I don't care what books you've read, what gurus you listen to, what life hack you're implementing. If you don't know how to deal with discomfort, emotional discomfort, you will always be distracted by something. And so what I want to teach folks, and the most important first step, is how do we master those internal triggers? Now, after we master those internal triggers, that's the most important step. Then we have to do what's called make time for traction. Remember, we talked about traction right earlier. The second step is to make time for that traction so that we can live out our values by turning our values into time. You would not believe how many people out there, 2/3 of Americans, don't keep a calendar. What? How can you call something a distraction?
That's surprising.
Isn't that crazy? And even the 1/3 who do, right? You're not off the hook. Even the 1/3 who do keep a calendar only keep it for their work domain, right? Just about work. Is our only value to be like workers all day? No. Do you make time on your calendar to take care of your physical, emotional, spiritual health? Do you make time on your calendar to be with your friends, your family, your kids? If not, you're probably neglecting those values in your life. So I show you how to turn your values into time. Then what we want to do is to hack back the external triggers. How do we make sure that we remove all the pings and dings and rings that don't serve us, not just on our devices, but also other people? What if you work in an open floor plan office, right?
That's
the number one source
here
of distraction is other people. In the modern American workplace, workers tell me, and several studies have shown this, it's not the technology that distracts people. It's other people that distract people.
Sure.
It's stupid meetings that didn't need to be called, superfluous emails that didn't need to be sent. That's the real source of the problem. And then finally, we can prevent distraction with pacts, the final step. We can make sure that we don't get distracted by doing what's called making a pre-commitment to make sure that we do what we say we're going to do. So that's the four steps. We master internal triggers, make time for traction, hack back external triggers, and prevent distraction with pacts. And it took me 5 years of research to boil down those five.
To get narrow it. That's awesome. Well, it's interesting too, because you said about the open floor plan. That's what we have. And all the time, my wife's like, I can't get my work done. I can't get my work
done.
Everybody's right. And so like today she's, you know, she's like, I'm staying home the half the morning. I'm working from home. The kids are, you know, out at we homeschool, but they're out at the, like this church homeschool thing today. And so she's like, I'm working from home. They'll knock out everything. And
so what do you do, right? So what do you? So she left.
Yeah, she just didn't even come yet.
So I argue you're not going to change the open floor plan office. It saves companies too much money. It's not going away. It saves them tons of money on real estate costs. Here's what you do: you use a screen sign. Every copy of my book, Indistractable, comes with this piece of cardstock in the middle of the book. You pull it out of the book. You fold it into thirds. It's bright red.
Okay.
You put it on your computer monitor. You can't miss it.
Right.
And it says, I'm indistractable. Please come back later.
Okay.
That simple technique of just telling other people, hey, I need to focus right now. I need to think. Please come back later is incredibly simple and very, very effective.
I am Josh Felber. You are watching Making Bank. Get out and be extraordinary.
Thank you for listening to Making Bank. If you have enjoyed this episode, please leave a review. And sharing is caring. Follow Josh Felber on Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram for more. You can also listen to Making Bank on Amazon Alexa, Spotify, iHeartRadio, and watch on Apple TV, SuccessThinkers Network, Amazon Fire, and YouTube.